Well, I suspect that almost anyone who knows me at all well knows that I'm a book person. I love to read, and I love to read all different kinds of books, and it's been a great blessing in my life to be a reader and to continue to be a reader. But if you were to ask about my favorite kind of books, I would get a challenge with it. Very high on the list would be biographies. I love reading about people. I love to see who they are. I don't mean the kind of trivial, gossipy stories of celebrities of various kinds that tell you what they did and applaud them. I mean the stories that get under the surface, get under the skin and tell you who this person was and how they lived and what they did. And I've just been reading a couple in the historical sphere and in terms of larger histories. But the ones that sustain me most deeply are meaningful biographies of Christ followers who down through the century have lived lives for Christ. It could be Athanasius back in early Alexandria, standing against the whole world of his day for the truth of the gospel, or a Martin Luther or John Knox during the Reformation, or as you read through the great missionary leaders pushing out into other parts of the world. I've read with them, I've cried with the Judsons being imprisoned in Burma and all of they went through. I've been instructed, I've been inspired, I've been encouraged, I've been rebuked, I've been challenged, I've been warned, because any honest biography tells me of mistakes that good and significant people made. And I stand back and I think how many of them have been my mentors through the years. Never met them, we'll meet them in heaven one day, and I will go to them and say, I need to tell you what an influence your life had on mine and how it shaped it and moved it. I remember as a teenager reading that Hudson Taylor had slept on the floor so he could be prepared for what life was like in China. And if it was good enough for Hudson Taylor, it was good enough for me. Lasted about 3 weeks. But those kind of things leave a stamp on you. And they've caused me to aspire more, to get on my knees and ask that the Lord would change me and make me more of a person whose life is there. And I've mentioned men, but there's the women of faith, the Amy Carmichaels and the Gladys Aylwards, and there's others that just come to my mind. So we're going to take a shift here, and we're going to think about a man. A man who God used in a powerful way. I was thinking through this week, who are the five most important people who in history? And in my mind, the five most important people in history are all going to be from the Bible, and they're all significant. And obviously, the most important who ever lived is the Lord Jesus. And you can argue with the list, but second has got to be Adam. I mean, none of us would be here apart from Adam. And Adam's not exactly a model of the best things in life, because we're fallen creatures because of Adam. And then there's two men who fight for, in my list, third place. One is Abraham, and the other is Moses. I'm interested in both of them because I guess it's the age I'm at. Both of them really didn't step forward and do what they're called to do until they were 80 years of age. So I've got some personal thing to think. 80, okay, my life isn't over yet. I'm still way under that. Just 25 Celsius. But on we go in terms of living life. And it's Moses that I want to spend our time thinking with over the next weeks. We'll be largely in Exodus. We're not going to do an exposition of Exodus. We're going to go through quite a bit of it, but not all of it, because it's Moses that we're thinking about. So I'd like us to begin by turning to Exodus chapter 1, where Moses doesn't appear, but it is a kind of stepping point into the life and story of Moses that he decided was important for us, since he is ultimately the author of what we are going to read. So, verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. And Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied, grew exceedingly strong, so the land was filled with them. Now, there's something that you can't see in your English Bible because it can't be represented in English in the very beginning of verse 1. Because if you were to take up a Hebrew Bible, you would notice that it begins with the word and or now. It's something that's called a vav consecutive. Now, the reason I mentioned that is the vav consecutive is part of a continuing story, and then suddenly the writer will stop and give a kind of step back. Now, here's some details you need to know about this. So when Moses begins with that statement that makes no sense to put in an English translation, what he's wanting us to understand is this is a continuing story. This is now, I just finished chapter 50, verse 26, Joseph died being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Now, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. So what he wants us to understand is as we begin volume 2, this is a continuing story of what God has been doing. So turn with me back to the seed of that, the roots of that, back in Genesis chapter 12. And we need to understand what the main thrust of the book of Genesis is and how this story is going to connect with that. In Genesis chapter 12, God breaks into human history in a new way. His hand is upon one man out of all of the peoples in the earth. 70 plus year old, childless man living in Iraq with no ultimate sense of destiny, but somewhere having come to know faith and trust in God as God had broken into his life. And we read now, the Lord, now Yahweh, said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless him, those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, this is a passage full of significance. I just want you to notice there are three aspects to it. There is a personal aspect, there is a national aspect, and there is a global aspect. The personal aspect is that statement, I will bless you and make your name great. So God has chosen Abraham out of all of the peoples of the world to bless in a particular way and to make him a blessing. Because the biblical principle is if you're blessed by God, you're blessed not for your own sense simply, but to be a blessing. And so Abraham is to become a great name. He's going to be an individual of prominence in all of the outworking of God's plan and program. And then there is not only a personal influence, there is a national influence. I will make of you a great nation. Now, a childless man in his 70s is not the most obvious candidate to be the source of a great nation. But nevertheless, God chooses that. Now, what does a nation require? Two primary things. It requires people, and it requires a land. And God is, in effect, promising, I am going to, because I'm telling you to get out of this land is not my land, there's another land, I'll show you the land. But he didn't give him any description of it or where it is or what it's going to be like. And I'll make you a great nation. And then the third is global. So out of this great blessing to Abraham and this great nation that will result from him, out of the midst of that, it says, I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Those who dishonor you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Abraham, I'm going to do something with you that has global dimensions. It is going to impact all people. Now, that's basically the program that God is calling Abraham to at this particular point. And in faith, as the story tells us, he steps out, he leaves there, goes to Haran, following the course of the Fertile Crescent and the Euphrates River, then is sent by God down into the Promised Land. And when he arrives, God tells him, this is the land. And there's a series of other things come. There's a famine. He goes down to Egypt. He comes back. And there's other stories. But turn to chapter 15. More than a decade later, he's still a fatherless man. He's in a new country, but he's still a fatherless man. And in chapter 15, verse 1, God appears to him again. After these things, the word of Yahweh came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I'm your shield. Your reward will be very great. But Abram said, oh, Yahweh, Adonai, what will you give me? For I continue childless. And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus, my main servant. He's going to one who's going to inherit all of this. And Abraham said, behold, you've given me no offspring. A member of my house will be my heir. And behold, the word of Yahweh came to him, this man shall not be your heir. Your very own son will be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward the heavens and number the stars if you are able to number them. Then he said to them, your offspring will be like that. And we have one of those marvelous statements in the Old Testament, fundamental to our whole understanding. So Abraham believed God. And it was counted to him for righteousness. It wasn't because he obeyed God, it was because he trusted God. And that had led him to obedience. But the promise is, out of you still is going to come all that I've promised. Now look down a little later in the chapter, and I don't want to go into the ritual, I just want to notice the parts of it. Verse 13, Yahweh said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, but they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back in the fourth generations, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Amorites being the local peoples in the land of Canaan as they were at this time. Verse 18, on that day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. Now, what he's giving is his program. He has a covenant program. Here's a man still without children, pushing the upper limits of age. And God says, I'm going to give you this enormous family. And he trusts God for it. But you need to know this. You're not going to stay in the land. You're going to be deported from the land or removed from the land. You're going to go to another land and you're going to be there for 400 years. But I'll bring you out and I will give you this land. Now turn to chapter 26. This is a little bit later, and it's interesting to see how this fits into the story. Verse 1, there was a famine in the land, meaning of Canaan, besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, and Yahweh appeared to him and saying to Isaac, do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. sojourn in this land. I will be with you, will bless you, for to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands. And I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands. And in your offspring all the nations of the earth will be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. It's not because of you, it's because of Abraham. And I made an unconditional promise to Abraham, and I will keep my promise. But even though you're the second generation and there's still no great nation and not very many, much of a family, I will make of you a great nation and I'll fulfill your promise. Now, chapter 46 of Genesis. Verse 1, Joseph is down in Egypt. He's called Jacob to come down, called the family to come down, and they are beginning their journey. And as they come to a journey, Isaac took his journey with all he had and came to Beersheba. Now, Beersheba was where Abraham had been centered. It is the southern limit, really, because it's desert beyond that, of the promised land in terms of its basically occupiable area. And he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel, to Jacob, in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. Then he said, I am God, the God of your father. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. Interesting, he told Isaac, don't go down to Egypt. Now he says, don't be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will bring you up again. And Joseph's hand will close your eyes. So the rest of the story is about the Joseph being there and Joseph spending the time there. And now we come to Exodus chapter 1. So go back there to Exodus chapter 1. And Exodus chapter 1 lives in the light of God's promise, program to take them down to a land, to have them in a place of affliction and of suffering where they're going to be for 400 years, and then to bring them back and to take them to the land. But you can imagine, we have the names in the first six verses of chapter 1, and the title, 70 people. And you take up some of the others, Joseph and his sons, and 75 of them. 75 people in the most powerful nation on the earth with millions of people. What are the chances of 400 years later they're even going to be identifiable? They're going to melt into the framework of what's happened in Egypt in any human term. They will just get carried away and become part of that. And that would be the normal expectation. No people can survive living in a foreign place for four centuries. Think back, 1600, and still to be identifiable in the year 2000 as a unique people. Not much more than the occupants of one ship coming over from Great Britain or somewhere else in the world. And then we come to verse 7. The list of those who are there, and it's connecting to the family. This is the family. This is the covenant family. This is the promised family. This is the people I was talking about, or that Moses wants to say. This is Exodus. This is Genesis chapter 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 26, Genesis 46. That's the family. And then notice verse 7. But the people of Israel were fruitful and multiplied greatly. They multiplied and grew excessively strong, so the land literally teemed with them. Now you'll notice some of that is language, be fruitful and multiply. That's Genesis 1 language. That's the promise that God gave to Abraham and to Adam and Eve as they were created by God. And God is seeing that fulfilled in this nation. So that by this time, there isn't just 75. As a matter of fact, we will find out later in the book of Exodus, I think it's in chapter 38, in Numbers chapter 2, in Numbers chapter 6, there are 603,000 men, 20 and above. Now, if you think that through, there's probably an equal number of women. You would guess maybe there's about an equal number of children, or perhaps a little bit more or less. That's 2 million people. But the point is that they are not just there, they are identifiable. They haven't been assimilated. They haven't been absorbed into that particular place. They are there and identifiable, and they are still present. And the book begins with this announcement that God is being faithful into his covenant promises, even though probably virtually no one in that generation remembered the roots back in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. God was at work. They didn't have written scripture. They didn't have the kind of things that we take for granted. This is the first bit of written scripture that Moses is bringing forth, as far as we can tell. But God is at work. But in the midst of that blessing, there becomes this kind of divine paradox that God's blessing often brings bitterness and hardship. This is going to be the next stage of what God is going to do, but it's going to happen in a striking way. So let's read verses 8 to 14. This next part has three stages of Israel's history at this particular point. And I'll kind of fill in that in just a moment. Now, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. So let's fill in the story. It was probably, and the dates that we give to this period of time, different evangelical scholars debate back and forth about some of them. I'm going to use the numbers that I think are appropriate, what's called the early date of the Exodus, rather than the late date. It's a secondary issue. I'm just sort of alerting you to that. So it was probably about 1800 BC that Jacob and his family came down to Egypt at that particular point. Maybe 100 years after that, some outsiders came into Egypt, and in some way they're known as the Hyksos. They became the dominant ruling power. And we don't know very much about them. They're just mentioned in passing in some of the records, but they were foreigners. That was something the Egyptians always distrusted, foreigners. And these foreigners had managed to get power. But there was a revolt, and around 1550, approximately, there came to be a new kingdom. So it's called the New Kingdom period of Egypt's history. And I think that's right around the time where we are when we get to chapter 1, verse 8, where this new Pharaoh has risen. Pharaoh is a title. It's not a name. And it's sort of like Your Majesty in the British kind of context. This new Pharaoh comes to the throne. And as he looks around and he's determined to establish that Egypt is for Egyptians and we're going to be in control, we're not going to let this happen again. His natural xenophobia, his natural dislike of foreigners, focuses on a group of people who've been flourishing in the country at that particular point. They've been there, but they've always been second-class citizens in a particular way. It says they were shepherds. The Egyptians had nothing to do with shepherds. They lived in a particular area, and so they had served the purposes, but now he sees them as a potential threat. And he plays the race card. It's kind of interesting in terms of things going on in our own culture at this particular time, but people in power wanting to get support, especially of locals, will play the race card. and it's happened over and over in history. This is an early race card. And you notice that he pours it down. Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Now, that's a huge exaggeration. These were shepherd folk. They weren't armed warriors, but they're outsiders. And he was feeding on the fact of suspicion of outsiders and people especially who don't mix in the normal way. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Now, that seems a little mixed. If he's worrying about them escaping from the land, then they will be fine. But nevertheless, he's playing whatever he can to get them to say, I want you to turn their attention to these people, and we are going to use them for our purposes. So now, all of a sudden, all of the pressure of the Egyptian people is going to come down on the people of Israel, and they are going to become slaves. They've been second-class citizens, now they are slaves, working under the power and control of all kinds of different ways. Look at verse 13. It says in verse 13, so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. We're going to use them for our purposes and work them as slaves, taking away their dignity, taking away their rights. Now, the verse I didn't read is the fascinating one. Did you notice verse 12? But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. Now, that's backwards. You'd think it would say, the more they multiplied, the more they were oppressed. But in some amazing way, God is multiplying them despite their oppression. And God is going to use their oppression to their own good in ways that they can't understand it. And God is going to make this a vehicle of his purposes. Now, I'm going to return to this later, but I want you to recognize something. That God is preserving the identity of these people in a very remarkable way. The persecution is a blessing. So let me review history. The Israelites, children of Jacob, were in Canaan. And in Canaan, they were slowly being assimilated and being Canaanized. And you read the story of the later chapters of Genesis, and they were becoming absorbed into the culture. So what does God do? He sends a famine into the area. He'd also arranged the life of Joseph. You remember Joseph? You meant it for evil, God meant it for good. He got Joseph down to Egypt, and then he sends Israel down to Egypt where they will be second-class citizens, to protect them, from the Canaanites, and their second-class status in some sense protects them from the Egyptians. But now he's turning up the heat. Why is he turning up the heat on them? Because they'd become comfortable even in their slavery. Slavery was not what they knew. They'd become accommodated to that. And now he's going to turn up the heat in Egypt, so when Moses comes back from God and said, God said, we're going to go, the people will be more willing to think about leaving. Even then, you remember, they get out, they're free, and what are some of them saying? The first sign of trouble, let's go back to Egypt. So God is using suffering, which looks like punishment, as blessing. And this, the harder it gets, God is at work. And did you notice the second half of verse 12? Making them slaves didn't make the Egyptians happy. Verse 12 says, the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. God is using this in a remarkable way. And so finally, the Pharaoh says, in effect, this isn't working. This problem of taking them and making them slaves, and this meant mainly the men, the women would be left to plant the fields and work the home and keep all of those things. We've got a new plan that we've got to put into motion here, and that is we've got to get rid of the male children. And it's a very long-range program because it's going to start with killing babies. You notice, then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of them was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, you will kill him. And if it's daughter, she shall live. Now, this is secret genocide. This isn't publicly announced. This isn't done by Egyptians. This is him putting the pressure on these two women. Now, if you think with me a little bit about this, it's extremely unlikely there were only two midwives. I mean, 2 million people, 600,000 women. So these must be the kind of leaders of the midwives. This is the midwife union, the top two. These are the representatives of it. It seems likely, I'll show you this in a minute, they were women who didn't have any children of their own. And whether they were married or not, I don't know, but they had the task of supervising the midwives in this particular direction. And apparently they listened to what Pharaoh says, and his plan is obviously to kill the boys, because we can always use the women for various purposes, for servants and also for immoral reasons. But we got to get rid of the men. But if you're going to start with babies, you know this is going to be a long-term program. It's not going to be worth very much for 20 years out until they're becoming of longer age. So how long this went on, we're not told. What we are told is the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded, but let the male children live. It's stated in the simplest possible way. They let the male children live. And Pharaoh finally gets word of this. You need to understand in all of this, giving birth, women's stuff, men had no interest in that. That was something that happened out of sight, out of place. So he was not monitoring any of this directly, and like a male, he was totally clueless about all of this happened. But finally, he recognizes something isn't happened that ought to be, and he calls in the Hebrew midwives and says, why have you done this, and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. If so, why did they have midwives at all? The only reason you have midwives is because that's not what happens. But Pharaoh doesn't know anything about giving birth in any of this, and apparently he accepts that at face value at that particular time. And the women allow things to go on for a certain length of time further because of their action. Now, we face a question here. Were the midwives lying, or was it really true? Well, almost certainly it wasn't really true. There had to have been at least a few where midwives were needed. So, yeah, they're lying. There we get into all kinds of, is it always sinful to lie? And all kinds of theologians and commentators on this, and you read them and say, it's going to talk about God blessing the midwives and say, God bless them for their faith, not for their lie. And I'm not comfortable with that. I think God didn't bless them despite their lie. It was through the lie. There are times when it is righteous not to tell the truth. That sounds like a contradiction or everything, but listen to the Ten Commandments is, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. They weren't bearing false witness against their neighbor. They were bearing false witness to protect their neighbor. They weren't using it in a particular way. If a man came to the door with a gun and said, your granddaughter's inside, and you go and get her and bring her here, I'd lie. Without any concern whatsoever, I'd lie and say, no, she's not here. She's not anywhere at all. And I wouldn't feel that I had done wrong in doing so. Now, I don't want to justify any kinds of lying, but there is such a thing as a dutiful lie. Corrie ten Boom was right to lie about protecting Jewish children during the Holocaust. You can disagree with me, that's fine. We'll get that figured out when the Lord comes. But what I want you to notice is about the women. It said, so God dealt well with the midwives. They were not punished for what they'd done. And the people multiplied and grew very strong. So the nation grows. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. That's why I said I don't think they'd had children of their own. Maybe they weren't married. Maybe these were single women. And God blessed them with the gift of families. And you can think of Rahab and other stories where you have these kind of actions in the Bible. But that brings now stage three. Stage one, enslavement. Stage two, covert extermination. Do it secretly. Don't let it be known. Now it all goes public. And we read, Pharaoh commanded all his people. So now it's a national program. Now this is Hitler at his strongest, shouting and screaming, pulling off Kristallnacht and demanding that all the Jews be taken away to, in all of that horrible program. Every son that is born to the Jews, of your baby boy, you shall cast into the Nile. You shall let every daughter live. We don't worry about the girls, but kill the boys. And you are charged to do it if you see a baby boy. Throw him into the Nile. The very river of life, which was the source of everything that went on in Egypt, is now to become a source of death. Well, we're going to get into the story of Moses next chapter, but here we're at the apparently lowest of places. But let me just notice five things as we pull it together. The first is, and it's not direct, but it's there, anti-Semitism is a very ancient disease. It has been around since the beginning of history. And the anti-Semitism that is here is clearly the work of Satan. And we'll come back to that in just a moment. Well, no, I'll say it here. The attempt to kill the baby boys of Egypt is a direct attack by Satan on God's promise to Adam and Eve about the seed. If the seed is destroyed, the Savior cannot be born. So this is not just an action where you're going to decimate people. This is an action where Satan is working centuries before Christ was ever born, and he'll do it time and again, up until the point that he has Herod attempt to kill all the babies in Egypt, to kill the promised line. And so it is here that we see the hand of Satan and something much more going on. Secondly, God often uses suffering for his purpose. We've already talked about that. He used the suffering of famine to get them into Egypt. Now he's going to use the suffering of prejudice and hatred and Pharaoh's anger and stubbornness of heart to get them out of Egypt. And for the people who are groaning, here's the remarkable thing. They're groaning, thinking God has forgotten us. But the very suffering that is coming upon them is a sign that God is remembering them and remembering his promise and remembering his purposes. And so God often uses suffering for his purposes. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? That Adolf Hitler was committed in World War II and before that to destroy the Jewish people. And the number one reason why the land of Israel came into existence in 1948, and for the first time in almost 2,000 years the Jews had a safe land, was because of Hitler's attempt to exterminate. And God used their suffering, and I don't want to say that's all, and that doesn't in any way minimize the evil of it, but God uses suffering for his purposes in many times. Third, God's blessing often coexists with profound adversity. If you listen to the prosperity preachers on certain television channels, they will tell you, you want to get a blessing? And it's always about prosperity. But God was blessing his people through adversity. And it may well be that some of the issues that are going in our culture now, as our culture becomes increasingly post-Christian, and the intellectual elite becomes not just post-Christian, but anti-Christian in many ways, that it will purge and purify the church if the Lord be not come. And some of the excess that is part of what's going on when it's relatively easy will be burned away by the glory of God. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I do know that God often prospers his people at the same time he allows adversity. Fourth thing is that God often works through the most unlikely agents. If you were to have a candidate about who will be the great heroes in Israel's history at that time, I suspect you wouldn't have come to two midwives. It's interesting in chapter 1, you may not have noticed this. Pharaoh's not named. No one else is named, that is, after the list in verses 1 to 6. It's just two obscure women who feared God, Shifra and Puah. God doesn't care about the name of Pharaoh, but he wants us to make sure we know Shifra and Puah, because it doesn't matter where your status, you can be used by God for his glory. And then the final thing. We can trust God's sovereign purposes even when we cannot understand his ways. God was at work, and the great task of the next chapters are going to be to get Moses to be able to trust that in the midst of all of this suffering and all of this confusion, God was still working his covenant promises. And we can be sure, even as we sang earlier, that God is sovereignly at work in our midst and in the world today. That although it looks like things are running out of control, they are not out of the purposes of God and his plan. He is, as the song we're going to conclude with says, he is sovereign over us. And we need to cling to that, even as we walk through the various stages of our life. So let's